podcast. For information on pitching us, your own story, and everything else, go to our website, themoth.org.
A busy traffic morning around the Bay Area. We go to Mel Baker now, who gives us the latest updates.
In the Corral Hollow fire, we're still having troubles on 580 in the eastbound direction as you head through the Altamont Pass. It remains closed. They'd hoped to open it, but it's remained closed all the way down to I-5. 580 westbound in Tracy is stop and go all the way back to MacArthur. Elsewhere, we're looking at problems on the Bay Bridge where there's construction work on both the upper deck and lower deck, which is causing backups into San Francisco and back to the Maze. Mel Baker for KQED.
Thanks, Mel. Traffic support comes from visitors' coverage. Support for KQED comes from Berklee Repertory Theater, presenting Galileo, a new rock musical starring Raul Esparza as the rebel astronomer, from the minds behind Spring Awakening and TV's Empire, playing through June 16th. BerkleeRep.org. Good morning, I'm Jean Marie. You're listening to KQED FM San Francisco and KQEI FM North Highlands Sacramento. The time now is 12 noon.
Today on the New Yorker Radio Hour, we make room for a grand piano and an astonishing singer.
If you should love me.
I'll talk with Cecile McLaurin-Salvan, who mixes jazz standards with ancient ballads and all kinds of surprises.
I think I have the spirit of like a kind of a radio DJ slash curator. Like I want, it's almost like making a mixtape for someone and only putting deep cuts. I want to find the gems that haven't been sung and sung and sung over and over again.
A studio performance from Cecile McLaurin-Salvan, a three-time Grammy winner. That's all ahead today on the New Yorker Radio Hour, right after the news.
To belong to you, write you a song from a distance.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. The White House is waiting for an answer from Hamas on the latest proposal for a ceasefire in Gaza. It calls for a six-week ceasefire, the release of some hostages and Palestinian prisoners, and an eventual permanent end of hostilities. White House National Security Communications Advisor John Kirby says the U.S. expects Israel will agree if Hamas does.
Where we are right now is that proposal, an Israeli proposal, has been given to Hamas. It was done on Thursday night, our time. We're waiting for an official response from Hamas. We would note that publicly, Hamas officials came out and welcomed this proposal. And so what would we hope would happen is they would agree to start phase one as soon as possible.
Kirby was interviewed on ABC's This Week. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says China is actively working to stop countries from attending a peace summit Ukraine and Switzerland are organizing for later this month. NPR's Emily Fang has more.
Zelensky alleged that China has not only avoided the peace summit, but has been blocking other countries from sending their leaders. He also said that last year, during a phone call with Chinese leader Xi Jinping, she assured him China would not send Russia weapons. But Zelensky said Ukrainian intelligence had found evidence that Chinese components were being found in Russian weapons. It is unfortunate, he said, that a big independent country like China is being used as a tool by Russia. Zelensky also said that he had not been able to meet with Chinese officials during his trip to Singapore, where China's defense chief also is currently for a security summit. Emily Fang, NPR News, Singapore.
Police in Akron, Ohio are investigating an overnight shooting that killed one person and wounded 24 others. Zaria Johnson with member station IdeaStream Public Media reports.
The Akron Police Department says calls came into the 911 center just after midnight, reporting multiple gunshots and wounded victims near Kelly and 8th Avenues on the city's east side. A firearm and several dozen shell casings were recovered at the scene. U.S. Representative Amelia Sykes from Akron encouraged community members to reach out to the police department with tips. In a statement, she said her office is prepared to assist in the investigation as needed. No additional suspect or victim information has been released at this time. For NPR News, I'm Zaria Johnson in Cleveland.
Police in suburban Pittsburgh are investigating an early morning shooting at a bar that killed two people and wounded seven others. Police say it appears an altercation took place in the bar and multiple individuals opened fire. There were no immediate reports of arrests. California firefighters are battling a wildfire that's burning about 60 miles east of San Francisco. It's now more than 12,000 acres and has been 15% contained. An interstate connecting the San Francisco Bay Area to Central California has been closed. This is NPR News.
Live from KQED News, I'm Natalia Navarro, here to bring you more on that fire. Firefighters are working to contain the Corral fire that started yesterday and grew quickly south of Tracy. KQED reporter Catherine Monahan is on the scene in Tracy. Now, Catherine, I understand you were able to speak to an official from Cal Fire in the last hour. What is the latest on the firefighting conditions?
Yes. Hi, Natalia. The winds are down at this point, which is helpful. Last night when the blaze got going, it was really gusting. So today, according to the fire chief, winds are relatively down, relative humidity is up. Fresh crews have arrived on the scene, and all of that's making it easier for the firefighters to now go on what they call an offensive attack, which primarily is burning ahead of the fire to remove the fuel in its path and kind of fence it in. So the chief said they expect to be out here for a few more days, but he's confident that they're getting the upper hand on the fire and getting it under control.
You're reporting now from the temporary evacuation center. What is the scene like there, and how are people doing?
It's pretty quiet here. There are tables set up with food. There's blankets. There's bowls of water for the pets. It's, you know, cool inside. It's a nice place to rest, but the volunteers here say just only four people have been through today to receive services. Last night, they said it was pretty busy. There were about 25 people that came through, but today, much quieter, and everybody's hoping that's a good sign.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
For updates during the day on the Corral Fire and details about evacuations, including San Joaquin County, go to kqed.org. I'm Natalia Navarro.
Support for NPR comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy and helping clients find balance. Clients are matched with one of 35,000 therapists for online therapy from anywhere at betterhelp.com/public.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. For every music lover, I think there are two basic forms of pleasure: the huge satisfaction of something you love done just perfectly, and then the thrill of hearing something altogether shockingly new. When an artist does both things at once, your head comes open a little bit, which is what happened when I first heard Cecile McLaurin-Salvan.
Here am I, lounging on the sands of my hourglass, feeling my mind slip off a cliff. I lost my mind.
She's a jazz singer for sure, someone on the level of Sarah Vaughan or Ella Fitzgerald, but her repertoire and her approach to performing are totally her own. A standard from the American Songbook might be followed by a tune from hundreds of years ago and across an ocean, as we'll hear shortly. And no two shows are ever alike. I once went to see her expecting things like how high the moon and how deep is the ocean, but the first thing out of her was a century-old murder ballad, some half an hour long. Wynton Marsalis has called her the kind of talent who comes along only once in a generation or two. Cecile McLaurin-Salvan has been touring the country and in between shows came to talk and to sing in our studio at WNYC.
Life's candy and the sun's a ball of butter. Don't bring around the cloud to rain on my parade. Don't tell me not to fly, I've simply got to. If someone takes a spill, it's me and not you. Who told you you're allowed to rain on my parade? I'll march my band out, I'll beat my drum. Turn at bat, sir. At least I didn't fake it, hat, sir. I guess I didn't make it. But whether I'm a rose of sheer perfection, the freckle on the nose of life's complexion, the cinder or the shiny apple of its eye,
only can die once. Right, sir. Ooh, life is juicy, juicy, and you see, I've gotta take my bite, sir. Get ready for me, love, 'cause I'm a comer. I've simply gotta march, my heart's a drummer. Don't bring around the cloud to rain on my parade. I'm gonna live and live now. Get what I want, I know how. One roll for the whole shebang. One throw, that bell will go clang. I am the target, and wham. One shot, one gunshot, and bam. Hey, Mr. Fortner, here I am. I'll march my band out. I'll beat my drum. And if I'm fanned out, your turn at bat, sir. At least I didn't fake it, hat, sir. I guess I didn't make it. Get ready for me, love, 'cause I'm a comer. I've simply gotta march, my heart's a drummer. Nobody, no, nobody is gonna rain on my parade.
Oh, man.
What I did there.
Wow. I am so excited to have you here today, and I have gone to see you at any number of places around New York, and just and not enough, because every time I go, I leave so happy and so surprised by what you've decided to sing on a given night. What goes into those decisions?
It's very nice to hear you say that you're surprised, because that's my first priority, I think. I just love to be surprised in life in general, by people, by the musicians I play with, by myself. That's huge for me when I'm looking for songs or listening to songs, and even just when as a fan of art and artists.
Well, this song is so associated with one singer in particular, maybe Barbra Streisand.
Yes.
And you take it on head on. Then on another night, I'll go see you. And you're singing, I don't know how many verses that was. We were just discussing this before we came in. It must have been 40 verse long blues song that no one had probably heard.
Yeah,
I think it was like a half an hour long.
It was a half an hour long blues and called Murder Ballad that Jelly Roll Morton did for Library of Congress years ago.
Let me tell you one of the things that I've said.
This woman who murders her boyfriend's lover, and then goes to prison. And there's a lot of profanity, and I had always wanted to sing it. So for like, I sat on it for 10 years thinking, where could I ever possibly do it and who would I do it with? And then I had a Valentine's Day concert at Jazz at Lincoln Center. And I thought, wouldn't that be for date night? Wouldn't that just be great? So
a date night with a little murder involved.
Yeah.
Decoration day.
Well, let's start from the beginning. You grew up where?
I grew up in Miami, Florida.
And what were you listening to at home? And who was filling the home with music?
I was listening to whatever my mom was listening to, and she loves everything. Cesaria Evora from Cape Verde, we were mm-hmm. listening to Youssou N'Dour from Senegal, we were listening to Los Tres Paraguayos, which is like Paraguayan folk music, we were listening to French music, we were listening to some jazz, mostly Sarah Vaughan, a little bit of Nancy Wilson, Gladys Knight, Aretha Franklin. We were listening to folk music, some bluegrass. I could go on and on, actually. A lot of Brazilian music.
And that's all due to your mother.
She has a huge, wide ear, and she traveled a lot in her childhood. And I think she brought back those travels in some way, or that traveling sort of feeling.
Where did she grow up?
she grew up in Tunisia. She lived throughout Africa. She lived in Senegal. She lived in Cuba. She lived in Dominican Republic. She lived in Honduras, in Haiti.
And what was the lingua franca at home? English, French, or both?
Franca. It was franca. It was French. It was French at home.
Yeah. From what I understand, from a profile in The New Yorker some years ago, there was a time when you were a kid, you thought you were going to study law.
Not so much when I was a kid. It was more after high school. I really didn't know what to do. And there was this political science prep school in this small town in France. My cousin was going. They had a law option, like first year law.
In a beautiful place, in Aix-en-Provence.
In Aix-en-Provence. And so I said, oh, why not?
What a good deal.
It was a great deal. My cousin was there. I've always liked school.
So off you go as a teenager to the south of France to study law, politics, history, and then something happened.
I always studied music alongside my other school activities. And
did you play an instrument?
Piano.
Mm-hmm. And you were playing classical, jazz, everything?
I guess I was playing classical, mm-hmm. but I was not really playing much. I was not practicing. I had to be bribed every week.
You're having
with
good
donuts.
Time.
to go to piano class. I just didn't like it. But I did it for 15 years.
And singing?
Singing, it's funny. I think singing for me is so social. I don't sing when I'm alone, or I sing very rarely when I'm alone.
Not
or at
in the
home.
Shower, not?
Not so much.
Walking down the
it's
street.
Not, no. It's very social. It's very communicative. It's about being with other people and telling them a story or telling them a secret.
So while you're studying in France, at a certain point you start performing as a singer with a jazz quintet. How did that happen? And how did you have the skills and the nerve to do that all of a sudden?
It was really my teacher at the music school, Jean-François Bonnel. I had sung for him a Sarah Vaughan song. He was adamant that I join the jazz class. I was probably the only native English speaker there, so maybe it gave me a little bit of an edge mm-hmm. with singing these standards. And he was just like, I got us a gig. We're doing a show. Within like 2 months of me starting in his class. And it was in a small jazz club. It was a tiny jazz club in Aix-en-Provence with like 5 people in the audience, but it was horrifying.
Tell me about the first night. What'd you sing?
I sang It's Only a Paper Moon. Mm-hmm.
Say it's only a paper moon sailing over a cardboard sea, but it wouldn't be make believe.
I sang Body and Soul. I sang Lover Man. I sang You're Just Too Marvelous for Words. Mm-hmm. In my best and most intense Ella Fitzgerald impression mixed with some Sarah Vaughan.
You're just too marvelous for words like...
So I get the feeling that you at a certain point early on, you're kind of like a magpie of different styles and voices that your teacher is giving you stacks of CDs to listen to. And one week it's Sarah Vaughan week, and one week it's Ella Fitzgerald or Billie Holiday or whomever. This is all coming in as kind of information. And none of them wins out. You don't become an imitator of any one of them, do you think?
I think as I go through the phase with whoever it is, I am trying to sing as best I can like them. I think that's what was happening. But I was failing. You can never really sing like
someone.
So
the failing is becoming yourself.
The failing is becoming yourself, yeah. And it's interesting, like the singers that he had me listen to, yes, there were those big ones, the famous ones. But what was more interesting was all of the music by people that are completely unknown or not celebrated enough, people like Lil Hart and Armstrong. Mm-hmm. If you're doing a Lil Hart and Armstrong imitation, no one's going to really
Very
know because they don't know who she is, right. Unfortunately.
Now, my sources tell me that the song you're going to do next is pretty radically different. It's called Can She Excuse My Wrongs?
Oh, and I would love to talk about this.
I want to know everything about it. It was written by an English musician who was born in the 16th century, John Dowland.
Yes.
Tell me about the song.
The lyric is attributed to this man named Robert Devereux. The music is John Dowland. Robert Devereux, Earl of Essex, who was Queen Elizabeth I's favorite, or one of her favorites. And it's an interesting lyric because he talks about his desire, and the desire can be read two ways, as a desire for her or a desire for power. And what happened to the Earl of Essex is that he was found out in a plot against her and was then killed. I mean, like, executed mm-hmm. by the queen for plotting against her. And the song basically is, it's just, everything is there.
Now, how did you learn about this song? Flipping around on Spotify or car radio? What?
I was taking lute lessons years ago. I thought
lute
that I would maybe learn a little bit of lute just for fun. And this is like a very, this is like a class, this is a standard classic. This is Don't Rain on My Parade.
In the 16th century.
In the 16th century, lute.
That's what they were playing at the Vanguard in the 16th
exactly,
century.
Exactly,
exactly. Gotcha. Okay.
He says, better 1,000 times to die than for to live thus still tormented. Dear, but remember it was I who for thy sake did die contented. And he does die. It's crazy.
Well, let's give it a go.
Okay. Let's see if I remember.
Can she excuse my wrongs with virtue's cloak? Shall I call her good when she proves unkind? Are those clear fires which vanish into smoke? Must I praise the leaves when no fruit I find? No, nowhere shadows do for bodies stand. Mayst be abused if thy sight be dim. Cold love is like to words written on sand, or to bubbles which on the water swim. Will we thus abuse it still, seeing that she will write thee never? If thou canst not overcome her will, thy love will be thus fruitless ever. Will thou be thus abused still, knowing that she will write thee never? No, but remember it was I who for thy sake did die contented. Was I so base that I might not aspire unto those high joys which she holds from me? As they are high, so high is my desire. If she this deny, what can granted be? If she will yield to that which reason is, it is reason's will that love should be just. Dear, make me happy still by granting this, or cut off delays that if I die must. Better 1,000 to die then for to live the still tormented. Dear, but remember it was I who for thy sake did die contented. Better 1,000 times to die knowing that she will write me never. Dear, but remember it was I who for thy sake did die contented. Better 1,000 times to die then for to live the still tormented. Dear, but remember it was I who for thy sake did die contented.
I screwed up some lyrics. We're good.
Okay, this is what happens after each song. The recriminations begin.
They all in the
you
studio.
You screwed something up.
In the studio, always. I was. It was. It's funny enough. I was.
I'm speaking with the extraordinary singer Cecile McLaurin-Salvant, a three-time Grammy winner for Best Jazz Vocal Album, and Sullivan Fortner accompanies her on piano. Our conversation continues in just a moment. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by Progressive Insurance, presenting Progressive's Name Your Price tool, which shows customers coverage options that fit their needs. More at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Support for KQED comes from Style Bath & Kitchen, providing design knowledge on how to pick the right kitchen faucet, cabinets, bathroom, shower or bathtub, and more in their new video series. Available on their website by searching Style Bath & Kitchen online. And Comcast Business, in partnership with Extreme Networks, presenting the first professional sports venue to be Wi-Fi 6E ready with hundreds of access points throughout Oracle Park. business.comcast.com/community.
There's a basic question in economics that's kind of hard to answer. How do you help people out of poverty?
What if the cure for people not having money was just giving them money? No strings attached.
On the next Planet Money, we look at the best way to give money to people who need it. And on How I Built This, we meet a man who is creating more affordable housing with 3D printing technology. That's on the next Planet Money and How I Built This from NPR.
And that's this afternoon at 3 here on KQED, followed at 4 by the TED Radio Hour.
Marine biologist Mara Hart studies the love lives of lobsters and all the seductive foreplay that happens before they finally mate.
For the next few hours, she will molt, so she sort of slips out of her shell, if you will. That whole time, the male guards over her.
Love Stories from the Ocean. That's next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick, and I've been speaking today with the singer Cecile McLaurin-Salvon. She's emerged as one of the great jazz artists of her generation. She was 21 when she entered the Thelonious Monk Jazz Competition, and that competition was about discovering the next generation of jazz masters. Winning is like getting the Heisman Trophy for jazz musicians, and she was a complete unknown.
I didn't think I would win. I had just lost a competition in France, in a small town in France. I mean, no knock to them, but I really didn't think I would make it past the semifinals. I was even shocked that they kept my audition tape in the first place. I went there completely astounded by all of the musicians. Herbie Hancock was like in the elevator with me. It was
wow,
scary and crazy. Everybody could scat. Everybody was going to universities in the U.S. I felt like a little country girl, country bumpkin. So I wasn't expecting anything. And both my parents came with me. My mom kept saying, I'm so, because she's the one who signed me up for that competition. She kept saying, I'm so sorry. This is crazy.
What were you going to sing?
I sang, there were two rounds. For the first round, I sang Bernie's Tune. I sang Monk's Mood, and I sang a Bessie Smith song,
which one
that she sings, called Take It Right Back.
Just leaping and rolling drunk, smelling just like you've been with any old skunk. Take it right back to the place where you got it. Mama don't want a bit of it left, yeah.
And it was a great experience because it was the first time anyone ever laughed at what I was singing. And I thought, oh my gosh, understanding.
How much do you sound like yourself now? How much did you come into your talent and sense of originality?
I think it's very raw, but there is something there that is like I can see where I went after. It was all there. The choice of like odd repertoire, the like intensely looking at the audience while I'm singing. But I was trembling and scared. And even for that time, I wasn't fully singing. I mean, you could hear the nerves. I mean, I can hear the nerves.
I interviewed in this room, in this studio at WNYC years ago, Rhiannon Giddens. And she, to me, she does a lot of things, but she does two things at once in the sense that she's a great performer, But there's an element of her that she's also a scholar. She's a musicologist. She is an evangelist for all kinds of music. In her case, wants to very much make the big point that country music is not a purely white hillbilly music, but a confluence of Black American music meets white hillbilly music, and all kinds of interesting things come out of it. It seems to me with different music, you're doing a similar thing with that Rhiannon Giddens does, is that you're introducing all kinds of things to the stage. You're not just, of course you do standards and Broadway show tunes and things that we associate in our minds with what Sarah Vaughan did or Ella Fitzgerald. But so many other things are on your mind to give us.
It's funny you mention her. Rhiannon Giddens is somebody who I have to thank so much for a lot. I first heard about her through Carolina Chocolate Drops. Mm-hmm.
Her first band.
I learned about the banjo and what that instrument is and how it's, you know, a product of the African diaspora. I did not know. And it felt affirming in a way as somebody who had always loved that music, but thought, oh, this is just some white music that I like.
Yeah.
Much like the grunge is white music that I like. And then realizing through her in large part that, no, that this is not just white music. This is actually music that originated with Black folks and with a mixture. So she's huge to me. I actually sing one of her songs in my shows.
Which one is that?
It's called Build a House.
Oh, yeah.
I love that song.
You brought me here to build your house, build your house, build your house. You brought me here, build your house and grow your
But do you feel that you have that in mind too, that there's a, that it ain't just by chance, that there's a project that you're building over time of introducing certain kinds of music to your audiences, whether it's in French or it's in English?
I think I have the spirit of like a kind of a radio DJ slash curator. Like it's almost like making a mixtape for someone and mm-hmm. only putting deep cuts. That's sort of how I feel a lot of times. If someone is to ask, oh, can you do a Cole Porter tribute? I'll be like, okay, sure, I'll do a Cole Porter tribute. But I want to find the gems that haven't been sung and sung and sung over and over again, and that we might love and fall in love with.
And yet we began our conversation, or your being here with Don't Rain on My Parade.
Yeah, yeah. Huge hit.
Why do you want to do something that's so familiar and so associated with one singer?
You know, a lot of the decisions are very intuitive, but that song for me is not about the fact that it's associated with Barbra Streisand. It's just such an optimistic kind
happy.
Of,
Make
yeah.
Happy.
And you, also, she's just like so strong in that lyric.
It's not enough that you sing across the centuries and so beautifully. You also write extraordinary songs.
Oh, thank you.
Tell me about the beginning of songwriting and how you went about it and what you were after.
I first started writing songs, well, I think as a kid I wrote one song in my own invented language with my cousin.
Can you sing it?
Shamuda, Shamuda, Shamuda Radi, Shamuda Ye, Polikala, Purukututu.
And how old were you?
Who knows?
Did you have a sense of what the lyrics meant?
Maybe at the time we knew what it meant. Now I don't know what
lost,
it means.
Lost to the mists of
lost,
time.
Yes. And I heard Abby Lincoln. I heard an album of hers called Holy Earth. And it made me want to write.
Oh, the holy earth's mural, seen from way up high, abstracted natural bas-relief with this from
The very first song I wrote, or that I remember writing, is a song called Woman Child.
Mm-hmm.
that was the title track of my second album. And then, yeah, ever since then, I've been writing.
And you're writing them with the piano, with not the lute?
Not the lute, not yet. I'm writing with the piano.
Why do I have a feeling that that's coming?
No. With the piano and with a window. I like to look out a window.
How do you spend your days?
Long walk, a lot of writing in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
And then eventually get to the piano at some point. And then embroidery, a lot of embroidery.
It's a lot of alone time.
Yes.
And how does that inform the music?
Wow, that's a great question. It is very introspective music.
Yeah.
And it is music about solitude, a lot of it, about solitude, about yearning,
mm-hmm.
About desire. And I think all of those feelings are clearly coming from the fact that it's so much alone time,
mm-hmm.
which I need.
I think I may be pressing my luck, but I'm hoping you'll sing Moon Song,
sure.
Which is on the album Ghost Song from, I think, 2 years ago,
yeah.
3 years ago. Tell me about the song before we hear it.
It's a song I wrote about wanting to want and loving that feeling of desire and that feeling of before the big thing happens, and almost not wanting the big thing to happen, just wanting to be in that prelude of it, because that's where all the excitement is, being far away from the object of affection and looking at them longingly.
So different than a 16th century lute-based song.
Maybe exactly the same as a 16th century. Maybe it's exactly Kenchi, excuse my wrongs.
Yeah, they had desire in the 16th century. Okay.
If you should love me, don't ever tell me. Show it, that's how I'll know it. In fact, it's better not to show me at all. Let me pine, let me yearn, let me crawl, let me write you a song. And long to belong to you, write you a song from a distance. Let me love you like I love the moon. Let me love you like I love the moon.
I want to thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. Thanks for
having
me.
This was great.
Thanks for having
thank
both
you.
Of us.
Cecile McLaurin-Salvant joined me in the studio playing live at WNYC along with pianist Sullivan Fortner. She's playing this month in Phoenix, Burlington, Cleveland, and more before heading to Europe. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy and helping clients find balance. Clients are matched with one of 35,000 therapists for online therapy from anywhere at betterhelp.com/public.
Support for KQED comes from Hassler Heating and AC, advancing California's electric initiatives by converting homes to heat pump technology. For installation or repair of heating and cooling equipment, visit hasslerheating.com. Support for KQED's car donation program comes from local Kia dealers introducing the EV6, available with AR windshield head-up display, providing turn-by-turn directions, hazard warnings, and more. More info at kia.com.
Next time on City Arts and Lectures, our guest is Justice Stephen G. Breyer. In 2022, after 28 years on the Supreme Court, Breyer was succeeded by Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson. He'll talk to Sarah Isker on the occasion of his new book, Reading the Constitution, Why I Chose Pragmatism, Not Textualism. That's next time on City Arts and Lectures, here on KQED.
And that's coming up next. It starts at 1 o'clock this afternoon and followed by On the Media at 2.
Since it went public, Truth Social has been ridiculed as a meme stock and for the unhinged posts of its now convicted felon owner. But
no one was really focusing on what was going on behind the scenes and the fact that this had the potential to become one of Trump's most lucrative companies.
Plus, the agonies of photographing a war zone. It's all on this week's On the Media from WNYC.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. In 1934, Zdeněk Kobek, a track star from Czechoslovakia, set the women's world record for the 800-meter dash. A year later, Kobek shocked the world by declaring that he was now living as a man, an announcement that gained him international celebrity. He eventually gave back the medals that he'd won in women's competitions.
Ano, mám známost a velmi krásnou. Vezmete si ji, samozřejmě. Well, he is going to work now in the French casino, you see. And then he'll start the game, maybe, like an athlete, you see.
He's going to train and compete against men.
Yes, that's it.
Around the same time, a popular British track star who held titles in women's competitions also transitioned. Both these stories contributed to panic over trans athletes. And remember, this was all the way back in the 1930s. And these stories also led to sex testing policies that still define sports today. That's the subject of a new book by Michael Waters called The Other Olympians, Fascism, Queerness, and the Making of Modern Sports. Michael Waters has written for The New Yorker and other magazines. He talked about The Other Olympians with our sports columnist, Louisa Thomas.
Can you tell us a little bit about Zdeněk Kobek?
Yeah. So Kobek is born in 1913 in what would eventually become Czechoslovakia. He's born before World War I, before it becomes independent. And kind of the capstone of his career is in 1934 when he participates in something called the Women's World Games, which, for just a slight bit of context, like basically the early Olympics had incredibly few sports for women, and track and field sports for women in particular was stigmatized. And so the Women's World Games was actually the highest level of competition for someone like Kobek, especially for the women's 800 meters, which was his main sport. And so in 1934, the Women's World Games is in London, and he both wins gold and sets a world record. And so that kind of puts him on the map. And then really what catapults him to fame ultimately is, you know, a year later in December 1935, when he does decide to transition.
And, you know, we're talking about gender here. Was using that word gender. I mean, in the book, you use the word sex as opposed to gender. And I was just wondering if you could explain that decision a little bit.
Yeah, it's a tricky thing to talk about. And I definitely wrestled with it, still wrestle with it. But essentially, I mean, at the time in the 1930s, there was no concept of gender and sex as distinct things. So like today we think of gender as this psychological, socialized identity, and sex as this kind of assigned identity roughly based on physical traits of some kind. You know, it's an imperfect assignment, but that's kind of what it is. And so in the 1930s, when people were talking about transitioning, they were only talking about sex.
And what was the media coverage like when he announced this transition?
It was pretty sensational. But I really think through all of this reporting, what you see is this like genuine sense of curiosity about Kobek and about sort of what it means to transition gender. And so pretty quickly after the initial wave of coverage, you have different sexologists and scientists of different kinds, doctors, writing into magazines, including some really prominent sports magazines of the era, kind of describing what this means and what it means to move between these categories, which I'm calling gender transition, but they would say something about like sexual metamorphosis, which just doesn't really translate to us today. And I think through it all, you see, you know, for all of the kind of bold-faced headlines that feel a little ridiculous in retrospect, you see this genuine just interest and intrigue about Kobeck and what he meant for what they were calling sex and kind of the possibilities of sex. It really was an era in which there seemed like such potential for sex and gender as we would describe it today.
So obviously 1935, 1936, especially in the sporting world, but also in the broader world, these are loaded years. I mean, what else was happening? I mean, the newspapers were also full of news of the rise of fascism. So could you talk a little bit about how Kobeck fit into that story as well?
Yeah. So in 1935, you know, kind of the biggest sports story is not Kobeck, but is rather the Berlin Olympics, which are happening the following year in the summer of 1936.
Berlin's great day dawns with the arrival of the Olympic flame at the end of its 2,000-mile journey from Greece. And meanwhile, a packed stadium and flag-draped cheering streets greet Chancellor Hitler on his way to perform the opening ceremony.
And the Berlin Olympics, I think today, are quite famous, but they are especially famous because they were hosted in Nazi Germany. And in 1935, a lot of the coverage in the U.S. around the Olympics was talking about this really intense boycott movement that was happening, where a bunch of American athletes and officials and activists were saying, like, we shouldn't glorify the Nazis in this way. We shouldn't give them this platform through which to sort of showcase their power and ideology in the form of the Olympics. This is an era in which fascism is rising throughout Europe, and you see it really directly trickle down into the sports world. And so while the public, as we're describing, was quite receptive to Kobeck, I think this is an era of fascism in Europe, and you start to see that in how actually policy gets crafted in response to him.
There seems to be a sort of disconnect between the public responses to these transitioning athletes. How did the sporting world respond?
Ultimately, what happens is that kind of a small group of sporting officials have this backlash to him, and they see the story of Kobeck transitioning gender, and they say that it is kind of a harbinger of things to come in sports, and that there has to be policy instituted. And I should say, for context, also, Kobeck only wanted to play men's sports. I mean, Kobeck was like, I just want to play with other men. Right. So it was kind of like a false conflation in the first place that these sports officials were making.
Right. It's a bit confusing because Kobeck transitioned, but what he inspired was actually a fear that men were disguising themselves as women and competing in women's sports in order to win. And so this policy that we're going to talk about, it wasn't originally aimed at trans athletes.
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, ultimately, like, what happens is that the IAAF, the track and field organizing body, in August 1936 at the Berlin Olympics, passes this kind of early, really rudimentary form of sex testing. The policy is very vaguely worded, as a lot of reporters actually did note at the time. And so the IAAF couches sex testing in this first form under its protest rule. And basically what it says is that if a competitor wants to lodge a protest against another athlete, and there's like this kind of vague allusion to like something doubtful about their bodies or something, like they describe it as like abnormal women athletes, quote unquote. So if a competitor wants to lodge a protest against a fellow athlete, they can, and then a doctor would physically inspect that athlete. They didn't define like what the doctor was looking for. They didn't define who would qualify as sort of being allowed to participate in women's sports. I mean, it really seemed to be a policy of, oh, we'll know it when we see it. But yeah, so this first form of sex testing was basically like an athlete could say, this person who beat me, like, I have questions about, and then that person would be subjected to kind of like a strip search, like a really kind of gross physical examination. And the IAAF at the time didn't even spell out what they would be looking for and who would qualify.
Right. So it's like this person has like what, hairy legs or muscular arms? I mean, this.
Yeah. No, yeah. For sure. I mean, you see in this era, I mean, you see lots of fear-mongering and panic around just like women, cis women who looked masculine, who had like big biceps, or there was this American sprinter named Helen Stevens, who had a deep voice because of a childhood accident, who was constantly a subject of these sort of rumors and fear-mongering about sex testing. And so, I mean, someone like that could be caught up in this too. There wasn't really a clear policy. It was just anyone who didn't fit this very normative idea of femininity in the first place. And I mean, for further context, I mean, this is an era too when there's so much fear-mongering about just women playing sports and especially playing track and field in the first place. And so masculine women in general were just subject to scrutiny and critique. And then essentially what happens is that sex testing expands and you first start to see letters back and forth from the IAAF in 1939 calling for the sex testing of all women in women's sports. And then after World War II, essentially all women are required to showcase a medical certificate proving that they had gotten some kind of gynecological exam that sort of quote-unquote proved that they were a woman or that they fit this sort of definition created by the IAAF. And later in the century, you could be randomly tested by the IOC, but the idea was that this wouldn't be testing just based on a protest from a fellow athlete, but this was kind of the default of anyone who wanted to compete in the women's category had to undergo some form of testing or had the sort of the threat of testing. Today, I mean, all women athletes are governed by these rules, but only certain women end up to be tested. And so as we talk about sex testing today, we often are forgetting where these policies come from in the first place, that they are the result of the Berlin Olympics in 1936, and they are the result of sort of these very specific officials who were certainly swayed by certain fascist ideas. And just that history of where these policies even came from in the first place has largely been forgotten.
Let me ask you about Kobach. So Kobach transitions. What happens to him?
Yeah. So in 1936, a few months after Kobach first announces that he's living as a man, he becomes kind of a global celebrity, and a producer on Broadway in New York reaches out to him and asks him to come to New York to perform in this variety show that he's putting on. And so in August 1936, as this discussion is happening in Berlin around sex testing policy, Kobach is, you know, taking the steamship from Czechoslovakia to New York. And then he has this kind of weird perfunctory role in this Broadway show for a couple of months in New York. And then after that, he goes to Paris to perform in this variety show where he danced alongside Josephine Baker. And so he's this kind of global celebrity for this moment in 1936. But he eventually gets a driver's license that identifies him as a man, and shortly thereafter he gets married to a woman. And this is an era in which, you know, the right, the far right is rising in Czechoslovakia, the Nazis eventually take over, and Kobach, I think by nature of having these documents that identify him as a man and by nature of just kind of receding from the spotlight, he ultimately does survive this sort of fascist era, in which many other queer and trans people are being sent to death camps and having these really extreme interventions by the Nazis. And then in 1944, he enrolls in this local team and for the first time gets to play in men's sports. And he seems to do it for a number of years throughout his life. And it's really this conclusion to his story that he gets to do what he always wanted, and he's doing it above all else for just the love of competition in the first place.
I mean, the discussion around sex in the Olympics and sex segregation in elite sport and, you know, elementary school sports, you know, obviously is a major culture war front today. You know, no longer are athletes, you know, required to do a kind of strip test, but how is that category defined right now?
Yeah. And so, I mean, really what you saw since the 1930s is, after all these strip tests got a lot of criticism, you see sports officials and the IOC eventually move into chromosome testing with the idea that we can sort of see who has the right chromosomes. And you see that happen in the 1960s. And then that got a lot of criticism from athletes themselves, from other officials, from doctors who were talking about how, you know, chromosomes even themselves don't neatly map onto sex. And, you know, you can have a mosaic of chromosomes and sort of not identify as intersex, for instance. And after all of that criticism, eventually the IOC moved to this kind of hormone-based testing, mm-hmm. which similarly, I mean, there's not like a cutoff between when a hormone level like switches from like female to male or something like that. You know, there is this spectrum of hormone levels regardless of who you are. And today, and most recently, what has happened is that Now, the IOC doesn't set an overarching policy, and so it's up to these individual sports federations, like World Athletics, to set their own policies. And so it's kind of this haphazard, sort of slapdash set of policies that are quite punitive to especially trans feminine and intersex women in sports. And of course, you know, what is lost in all of this discussion is just the human toll and just the lack of respect for these really successful trans and intersex athletes themselves who, you know, have just become these political pawns and who just want to play their sport.
There's a book that you cite at the end of yours by Katie Barnes, Fair Play, which I think does a pretty good job of laying out some of these, the evolution of the understanding of some of these debates around trans people in sports. And they basically describe sex as the result of the interplay of chromosomes, sex hormones, internal reproductive structure, gonads, external genitalia, being this very complex thing. And yet it is complicated because, you know, certainly among elite athletes, there is a demonstrated effect of going through testosterone-driven puberty. Times in men's events at the elite level tend to be 10 to 12% faster in track, let's say, or in swimming than in women's events. So I think that part of what makes it complicated for even people who are sympathetic to the fact that there is this human element, you know, that want to see trans people just play their sport. I'm like willing to admit that the categories are complex and more complex than, you know, our current conversation allows. But yeah, I mean, there is just like a demonstrated effect, like the times are what they are. And I'm wondering what you think of that.
Yeah, I mean, it's a complicated subject that I don't think that like I as a historian want to be the one ultimately trying to like litigate. But I think to me, what is striking about reading the contemporary policies is the fear-mongering that has been focused on these trans women and intersex women in sports. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you're a successful trans woman athlete, you can't play in most of these Olympic sports. You can't play in the sport that corresponds with your identity.
One of the things that's so striking to me is that a lot of the policies, certainly in the United States, are actually not targeted at Olympic athletes.
Yeah.
We're talking about children often. Barnes' book, for instance, Fair Play, is not any kind of structured as an argument, but at the end they do sort of say, well, here's my opinion. And they say, maybe we should end sex segregation for, you know, elementary school, let's say, while acknowledging the, you know, perhaps some sort of restriction at the elite level is appropriate. But they made it very clear that there should be a path toward inclusion and that not only should trans people be allowed to compete, but they should be allowed to win, which is a lot of, you know, a lot of people have no problem with, you know, trans people competing as long as they're finishing last, you know, if the question arises when they start to win.
I mean, there are all of these other invisible advantages that we don't talk about in sports, like class, for instance, you know, just having the money to afford trainings in the first place has such a strong correlation with your level of success in these competitions. And that's something that we're not regulating. Like, we've accepted that there's these advantages. There are all kind of physical advantages around heights, et cetera, that we don't try to regulate in this way. And so I hope that even just by seeing kind of where these policies come from in the first place, maybe allows us to add some nuance to this conversation too, and see that sex testing itself is a very subjective policy that was created in a very specific moment and maybe doesn't have to be inevitable in sports, at least in the way that it's structured currently.
Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Michael Waters is the author of The Other Olympians, Fascism, Queerness, and the Making of Modern Sports, which comes out next week. Louisa Thomas writes our column, The Sporting Scene, at NewYorker.com. And she'll be joining us soon to talk about the upcoming Olympics. I'm David Remnick. Thanks for listening to the show today. And thanks again, too, to all of you who have been writing in about our election coverage, sharing ideas and observations and questions. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of TuneYards, with additional music by Louis Mitchell. This episode was produced by Max Balton, Adam Howard, Kala Leah, David Krasnow, Jeffrey Masters, Louis Mitchell, Jared Paul, and Alicia Zuckerman, with guidance from Emily Botin and assistance from Michael May, David Gable, Alex Parrish, Victor Guan,